Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marcia Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist and author of several books, most recently the national bestseller, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta, and Slate, among other publications, and has served as editor of the Russian-language magazine Snob, and was fired as the editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with the cranes. Her latest book, just out, is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marcia Gessen.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And I guess our congratulations in order, in as much as you now become an American. Well, you have been an American, but now you've moved to the United States, right?
I am an American again, yes.
You are.
Re-immigrated after more than 20 years.
And is there some sense of sorrow and loss that you've – I mean, tell us why you don't feel comfortable in your former homeland.
Right. Well, I'm a lesbian, and my partner and I have three children together. So the anti-gay campaign that the Kremlin has been waging has had a direct effect on us, and we feel that we have a well-founded fear that – the authorities will go after our kids. In fact, they've said as much. So so we had to leave the country. We really had no choice. There's obviously a sense of loss because, you know, unlike most people actually anywhere, I made a conscious choice to live where I was living. I moved back to Russia after more than 10 years in the States. My family had immigrated here when I was a teenager. And I had made my home there. So, yeah, losing your home, especially when you're well, maybe not especially, but anyway, losing your home when you're in your late 40s and you feel very, very rooted and entrenched is incredibly difficult. That said, there are certainly worse places to end up than New York City.
Well, Marcia, though, it does seem that that these laws, these homophobic laws that were put through by Putin and United Russia, they do have a kind of vigilante component, don't they? They say that it's all about protecting children. So that's where the threats are. And aren't sort of homophobic thugs, in a way, free to enforce the law?
Absolutely. And that's been very clear. There's been a huge rise in anti-gay violence and all sorts of anti-gay violence, sort of organized for the cameras violence and random street violence, and violence among people who are acquainted with one another, who can identify one of their acquaintances as gay. Some of the very few people who have been apprehended for this kind of violence do claim a patriotic motivation.
And what's your sense then of the failure, in effect, to get a boycott going against Sochi? I mean, I know the United States appointed a gay American to head up their Olympic delegation, but it would seem to me that Putin's assurances that no visitors are going to be harassed in any way misses the point.
Right. There was never a consensus in Russia or outside of Russia about whether there should be a boycott. I think there was a consensus sort of going into the fall that there should be a political boycott. And so far, that's not going too badly. I mean, a political boycott is essentially asking heads of state not to go, highly placed officials not to go, and starting in early December, the presidents of Germany, France, Poland, Lithuania, Estonia, and a couple of other countries have said that they're not going. And President Obama appointed a brilliant delegation. It's actually there are no highly placed government officials in either the opening ceremony or the closing ceremony delegation. That is the first time that's happened in a couple of decades. And there are several openly gay athletes in both of those groups. The group that's going to be at the opening ceremonies is headed by the University of California president, Janet Napolitano, and the group that's going to be at the closing ceremonies is headed by a deputy secretary of state. So it's a wonderfully designed snub.
So, again, I'm speaking with Marcia Gessen, a Russian-American journalist and author of several books, most recently the national bestseller The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta, and Slate, among other publications, and has served as the editor of the Russian-language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with cranes. Her latest book just out is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. And I wasn't aware that the punk prayer actually does incorporate the conversation we've been having so far, Marcia. Just reading the words of the punk prayer that was paid, was spoken or that was performed in the boom to the music of the boombox inside the cathedral that led to the arrest or the flight of two of the members and the arrest of the other three. Two of whom you've had close contact with, the punk prayer, just reading a couple of lines. Virgin Mary, Mother of God, chase Putin out. The Phantom of Liberty is up in heaven. Gay pride sent to Siberia in a chain gang. Virgin Mary, Mother of God, become a feminist. So give me a sense then of how this kind of the narod, the populace at large, which does have a lot of both racial prejudice and sexual prejudice, how are they responding? What's your sense of the extent to which these courageous young women have changed minds or opened minds?
Right. Well, yes, I'm glad you pointed that out, because I think that it's incredible that Pussy Riot are as good as they are at sort of pointing at the key issues of the day. At the time that they performed the punk prayer, which is almost 2 years ago, which is the protest at the Cathedral of Christ the Savior that got them arrested, at that time it wasn't clear to most people, certainly wasn't clear to me, that the anti-gay campaign was going to become a key issue in Putin's crackdown. In fact, Putin's crackdown began with the arrest of the members of Pussy Riot, which also happened on the date that he was supposedly reelected to his third term as president. As to their ability to change minds, I think that that would be much too much to ask. In a country where the media are controlled by the state and have been since these women were in grade school, it would be unrealistic. What they have done is forced several important issues on the liberal intelligentsia, and I think that's been very important. They have forced the liberal intelligentsia to think about sort of the limits of appropriateness in protest, which is an increasingly important issue for the Russian opposition. They have forced the issue of the symbiosis of church and state, and whether it is any longer acceptable for somebody who identifies as being anti-regime to also identify as belonging to the Russian Orthodox Church. That's a heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching issue for a lot of people in the opposition. And, of course, they actively predicted the anti-gay campaign. And that's been also something that is for the liberal intelligentsia to choose, you know, which side of history to be on. And I'm happy to report that I think most of them, all thousands of them, have made the right choice. But you know, hate sells very well, and I think hate sells very well anywhere. And I think if you imagine this country, I'm in New York now, where their airwaves are completely controlled by a rabid, xenophobic, homophobic entity, which beams to 98% of the households these messages of hate 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. I think that would have a profound effect. It's an easy message to get and an easy message to deliver. And the space available for the independent media keeps getting smaller, even, you know, past the point where we thought it couldn't get any smaller.
And it would seem that there was also a political message, or hardly an accident, that the punk prayer took place in the cathedral. The Russian Orthodox Church patriarch, who wears a $40,000 watch, didn't he make a prayer thanking God for Putin?
He did. He not only he has actually compared Putininess to godliness. He has attributed Russia's economic prosperity under Putin in equal part to God's will and Putin's wisdom. He campaigned heavily for Putin in the lead up to his election in March of last year, and he also directed Russian Orthodox believers not to participate in protests.
So this is a little odd, is it not? This is a blending of church and state in a toxic display of racism and homophobia. But I suppose in this country you can make the analogies with elements in the religious right who are also homophobic. And of course, in the South, there's a residue of racism. So, is there a similarity there? I mean, obviously, for anybody who truly understands Christianity, this is the religion of love, not the religion of hate.
Well, I'd like to make two points about that. First of all, there's more than a similarity. There's a direct connection. The United States has been exporting its extreme right to Russia for the last couple of years. The people who can hardly get a pulpit in this country anymore are lecturing to the Russian parliament on family values. This has it's sort of come full circle. Russia is now aspiring to being the traditional values capital of the world, and it has the assistance of several prominent American Christian fundamentalist activists in this quest. As for Russia itself and the Russian Orthodox Church itself, there's a long history of the church doing the state's bidding. In fact, that history goes back to Peter the Great. And more recently in the Soviet period, the church hierarchy was closely linked to the KGB. So the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church and Vladimir Putin, a former KGB agent, come from the same corporation. They really are in symbiosis.
So, Masha Gessen, again, the author of the new book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Let's turn to the women themselves, and particularly the two that you had extensive access to, as well as their families. Nadija Telekonikova, who you interviewed in the Gulag, right? And then Maria Alihina, who you also had corresponded with extensively. Explain how that was done, given the kind of police state nature of Putin's Russia.
Right. So three members of three participants in that action were arrested in March of 2012. They were Nadezhda Telekonikova, who's sort of the mastermind behind Pussy Riot, Maria Alihina, and Katerina Samutsevich. Samutsevich got a suspended sentence. So she was also sentenced to 2 years, but her sentence was suspended. She was released in October. And two, Maria and Nadezhda, were shipped to penal colonies, which, as we have found out, in many ways, thanks to them and their recent work starting in prison, have changed very little since the times of the Gulag. They're still based built on slave labor and humiliation and torture. I started corresponding with Nadia and Maria. Their lawyers asked them for permission to talk to me. Communication with lawyers is largely confidential. And then following some simple guidelines, we could correspond using the online system for corresponding with inmates. So one of the guidelines was that I was using a pseudonym. I signed my letters Martha Rossler, who's an American contemporary artist, with whom I think I have very little in common, so that caused me some discomfort. But this was the pseudonym chosen for me by Nida, so that was the easiest thing to use. In addition, Maria gave me access to the letters she had written from prison to family and friends. And, of course, that was much more open and intimate than anything she could have written to me. We were strangers, basically, before I started writing the book. It also gave me a long view, because she started writing those letters when she was first in pretrial detention, and you can see her evolution. So there are extensive excerpts from those letters in the book, and I think that's some of the most striking material in the book, because she's also, among other things, a remarkable writer. And Nadia and I had extensive correspondence over the course of several months, and then her friends and her husband were kind enough to give me a spot in, on one of the meetings with her, because you get inmates get one short-term visit, one four-hour visit every 2 months, and two adults can be present, so, and one child. So I accompanied Nadia's husband, Peter, to one of those visits, and basically it was a four-hour interview, which is a very long and intense interview by any measure, but of course, being the only journalist who was interviewing her in prison, aside from some journalists who interviewed her for state television, for propaganda purposes, that was particularly intense. And it was a very important also conversation to keep in mind for my own understanding of her evolution in prison.
Well, I take it a lot of what was moving about the letters and about the situation that these young women are in is that they're both young mothers, right? And they've been denied access to their children, who, what, about a third of the children's lives have they've had missed their mothers?
This is correct. Their children are 5 and 6 years old. Nigel's daughter is 5 and Maria's son is 6. So yes, they've missed a third of their lives. They were in prison for just under 2 years. And I actually watched Gera, Nadia's daughter, interact with her mother in prison. And it was very painful to watch. You could see them both being sort of physically uncomfortable with each other, longing for each other but not knowing how to act, missing a common language, the sorts of things that we take for granted when we talk to our kids. And, of course, it also sheds a little bit of light on Putin's amnesty, which knocked 2 months off of their sentences, because both Nadia and Maria appealed on several occasions to have their sentences either shortened or suspended or postponed until their children were older. There's a provision in the law for it, but they were both denied. The judge in one of Maria's hearings said, well, having a small child didn't prevent her from committing a felony, so there's no reason it should get her out of jail. And then Putin goes and amnesties women who have small children in a great show of humanitarian goodwill, so that their prison sentence is commuted from 2 years to 22 months.
And this followed, of course, the release of Mikhail Khodorkovsky from 10 years in prison. And it's clearly these acts of magnanimity from Putin are everything to do with the showcase that he's putting on in Sochi, I take it.
Absolutely. All of these, this actually happened simultaneously. The amnesty for Pusserat, the amnesty for the 30 Greenpeace activists who were kidnapped in international waters in September and held hostage for 3 months in Russia, and the release of Mikhail Khodorkovsky. And what makes it completely transparent is the fact that at the same time that these high-profile political prisoners were being released, people that you haven't heard about, like the environmental activist Evgeny Vitishka, who has been very active in the campaign to expose human rights and environmental violations that are part of the Sochi construction, he was sentenced to 3 years in prison the day that Mikhail Khodorkovsky left jail.
So when you visited Nadia Telekhanikova in the Gulag, I take it that she describes how, in your book, how when she, the warden at the penal colony, informed her that you should know that when it comes to politics, I am a Stalinist. So, I mean, you know, I guess what Putin has done in Russia is he's basically killed politics, right? There are no longer any politics in Russia. It's just a very cynical exercise. But has Stalinism returned, or is it getting a breath of fresh life?
Stalinism has certainly been so rehabilitated as part of the Russian legacy. But more than that, an intentional and well-articulated cruelty has become sort of all the fashion. That comment that Nadia heard from her warden is echoed by a comment one of the Greenpeace activists heard from his warden. His warden said, I think that the Gestapo has gotten a bad rap. So these guys are not only sadists, but they showcase their sadism. They get points for their sadism. Their sadism is an end in itself.
Well, much of the homophobic remarks that directed at you and others in Russia are also sadistic, are they not? They're talking about gays should be burned alive.
Gays should be burned in ovens alive.
Well, that's obviously, back to the Gestapo again. I mean, it's difficult not to extricate that kind of hatred and thuggery and brutality from both in terms of racism and homophobia.
Yes, the historical references are clear, and sort of the absence of any kind of cultural judgment placed on those historical references is also clear. And that, I think, is exactly what makes contemporary Russia just such a scary place to live and certainly to raise children.
And that, I don't recall that happening in the Soviet Union because, the Soviet authorities made such a big deal out of the Great Patriotic War. So I can't imagine that it was consistent with their propaganda to be pro-Nazi or to make...
That's a very difficult thing to unravel because Putin also continues to make a very big deal of the Great Patriotic War. And the Great Patriotic War remains sort of the great unifier of all Russians, the last event in Russian history that more or less everybody can agree on. It's a great thing that the Soviet Union participated in defeating fascism, or if you listen to Russians, that the Soviet Union defeated fascism single-handedly. But somehow that does not extend to the nature of fascism. That does not extend to drawing a line between the ideologies and sort of the spirits of Stalinism and Hitlerism. There's good reason for that. Historically, there was never a huge ideological distinction. Historically, the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany were allies until Nazi Germany attacked. And right after the end of World War II, censorship kicked right back in, and any discussion of the Holocaust was basically heavily censored, if not outright excluded in Russia. So it has never been wrong in Soviet or Russian culture to hate others because they're other. In fact, it's been the dumb thing.
So, leave us on a note if you can.
It's not, yes, I know. We're just going downhill, aren't we?
I know. It just a little bit beyond despair, shall we say. You know, I'm not asking for much here, Masha.
I went back to interview Nadia and Maria right after they got out of prison. And they're an inspiration if there ever was one. They have used the 2 years in jail to grow, to educate themselves, and they have emerged. They went in as college students who had created this incredible prank that was brilliant, that was prescient, but that was a prank. They came out seasoned, articulate political activists. I still couldn't help being struck just by how young they look and sometimes sound. But I'm also struck by how brave they are and how determined they are. And if there's hope for Russia, they're it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Masha Gessen.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Masha Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist and author of several books, most recently the national bestseller, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta and Slate, among other publications, and has served as editor of the Russian language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with the cranes. Her latest book just out is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about how the representatives of the 1% have become the 1%.